Good afternoon, everyone. Can I have your attention, please, because we want to kick off today's event. If you haven't already, please turn off your mobile phone. And a couple quick notes about events next week. On Monday, Donald Zong, the chief executive, is going to come to the club. He's going to title of his talk, suggested by his office, not ours, is A Dialogue with Donald, the Future of the Past. He wants to talk about heritage preservation in Hong Kong, in this this wonderful building. We're looking forward to that. And of course, if you want to ask him questions about subjects other than heritage preservation, I'm not going to stop you. And also, please remember that next Friday, June 19th, we're going to have the formal 60th anniversary piss up down in the main bar at 7:30. Be just a very informal occasion for members to come and have some drinks and toast the club. Today, continuing with the theme of heritage and preservation or lack thereof, I'm very happy to have Jasper Becker down from Beijing to talk to us about his latest book, City of Heavenly Tranquility, which came out actually just before the Olympics last year. Jasper is a former colleague of mine. When I joined the SCMP China desk as the Guangzhou correspondent back in the spring of 2000, Jasper, of course, was the Beijing bureau chief. Also happy to have in the audience today another member of that the China desk, Mark O'Neill. And I remember when Mark heard that I was joining, he called me up and said, "Ah, welcome to the dream team." Now, I'm not sure that either Willie Lam or certainly Wang Xianwei thought of us as the dream team, but it's nice to have three members of that desk back under the same roof this afternoon. You know of Jasper's work. It was always very humbling because Mark and I would run around writing newspaper articles for the SCMP, as would Jasper. But Jasper always had a book on the go as well, which is something Mark and I could never figure out. And not just one book. He's done six over the years, four of them on China. Of course, you'll all be familiar with the award-winning Hungry Ghosts about the famine during the Great Leap Forward, a travel log on Mongolia, and also a book on North Korea. In fact, he's spoken here before on North Korea, and also, what was the other one? On the Hungry Ghosts. Jasper's knows what he's talking about when he's talking about old Beijing and buildings. He himself is a Beijing landlord with more than a few properties. I, however, was rather shocked to learn today that, in fact, he's soon to leave Beijing after almost 18 years. He'll be going back to Bath, of all places. Very hard to imagine Beijing without Jasper. Jasper, thanks for coming to the FCC.
Thank you very much, Tom. Thank you also for coming out here to listen to me. Yes, I am leaving Beijing, and this the book was really sort of thought of as a kind of valedictory, kind of swan song about Beijing, because it was, you know, coming to Beijing in 1985 for the first time, which made me fall in love with China and with Chinese culture, and it's been a very painful experience to witness the destruction of Beijing or the rebuilding of Beijing. And so I kind of wrote this book really as a celebration of the things I loved about Beijing. And the original commission for this book was by a lady in London who wanted me to write a book similar to the one written about Venice by the British writer Jan Morris. And she said, "And look, this book has been in print for the last sort of 50 years and people still read it. We want something like that about all the sort of quirky, unchanging ways of the Pekingese or the Pekingers. I could never decide which was the right one. And, you know, and so I started sort of writing about all the things that I really sort of loved about Beijing, of course the Hutongs, but also about, you know, the birds and the ancient trees and the food and the crumbling old temples and all this kind of thing, the language. You know, this book took quite a few years to write, and meantime editors came and went. And as I was writing it, I, of course, you know, had to come to the conclusion that whatever I was writing about was disappearing. And so I had to change the subject of the book and the style of the book to really explore a different issue. And that is why did the Chinese leadership decide to destroy Beijing, old Beijing, Lao Beijing. And from that, that sort of went on to really explore the theme of the Chinese modernization project and the whole attitude to China's cultural patrimony and how that has affected attitudes not just to city planning and architecture, but also to literature, to painting, to design, to food, to almost every aspect of China. And one of the sort of, so in a way this became less of a whimsical book, but more of a kind of exploration of really the question of whether all that's been happening in the last 20 or 50 years, some say 100 years in China, has actually been a planned and systematic destruction of Chinese culture. And I didn't want to write this as a kind of polemic, because there was a lot of things I wanted to express my admiration for. But it's one of the themes in the book, and the book came out nearly a year ago, and that means I've had some reactions to it, and some people have really questioned whether, you know, this, what's happened to Beijing has really been deliberate, or whether it's just a kind of haphazard destruction that was not really envisaged by the Beijing leadership, and it's been driven by corruption and by the kind of hasty speed of China's industrial growth and the need to kind of drive up the profits of the steel and the cement industries and so on. And there are also some people who believe that actually it's been a jolly good thing that all these wonderful new buildings have gone up, and a lot of people have expressed admiration for some of the architecture in Beijing. My feeling is that this actually is a planned and systematic destruction, and the Chinese leadership is guilty of really a cultural crime of the first order of magnitude, because Beijing was a city that was really unique in the history of Asia. It was the home to five dynasties. It was where the whole modernization project was launched at the end of the Qing dynasty. It had a unique importance for all the neighbors of Beijing. It's a World Heritage Site. It's an artistic center, a religious center. There were, one American scholar reckons, something like 2,000 temples and shrines in Beijing. It's kind of like the Rome of Asia, if you like. And quite astonishingly, this city survived almost intact from the Emperor Yongle's time down to 1949, when Mao's armies marched in. And even when I arrived there in 1985, a lot of it was still recognizably there, although of course the walls had gone. And as I was sort of thinking about the speech today, I dug up a story which appeared in the New York Times at the end of the last month about the destruction of Kashgar, which was one of the last sort of intact Central Asian cities. And and the writer there, Michael Wines, in the New York Times was saying that this decision to rebuild, to destroy 85% of Kashgar, you know, was a decision that was taken abruptly by the central government 6 months ago. And I think that's very much what happened in Beijing in 1997 when Jiang Zemin engineered this coup against the then party secretary Chen Shih-tung, and he ousted them on the grounds that he'd been corrupt and he'd accepted bribes from these a certain Hong Kong property tycoon to develop a big shopping plaza near Tiananmen Square. And in fact, this was rather ironic because Chen Shih-tung was one of the few people in the Chinese leadership who actually did not come from an engineering background. He actually had an arts degree. And whether of his own volition or because of the collective decision of the party leadership, he had actually been responsible for a number of plans for Beijing which envisaged the preservation of old Beijing, and there were sort of strict rules limiting the height of buildings within the old city walls, and they experimented with sort of various types of new architecture which would sort of keep the sort of low-level Hutong courtyard style of Beijing. And particularly after 79, there was kind of a huge effort in Beijing to actually reverse some of the destruction of the Mao era and to list all the buildings and monuments and hutongs and palaces that had to be preserved. And when sort of Jiang Zemin really established his grip on Beijing and brought in his own people to run it, that was his opportunity to throw these plans in the bin. And there was no real public consultation except for the design of the Grand National Theatre, and which Mark at the time wrote a great deal about. But that was the only thing. So I think, and from what I heard from many people while I was researching this book, The decision was actually taken in secret, and a lot of people, even in the architectural profession, didn't realize that the party envisaged the sort of destruction of about 85% of Beijing. Some people say 94%, and since then they've moved something like three million people out of the center of Beijing. And to me, it's a little bit like the sort of Kashgar story. It seems to me, you know, this was a kind of collective punishment by Jiang Zemin on the people of Beijing for the Tiananmen rebellion, the Tiananmen uprising, when so much of the population went on into the streets. And in a similar way, the resettlement of the Uyghurs in Kashgar as a kind of punishment for their independence movement. Some people would say this is sort of going a bit too far, and that what has happened in Kashgar or Beijing has actually happened all over China, and therefore it's not a special case for Beijing. And I have met some Chinese architectural historians who've claimed that something like 320 historic cities in China have been more or less demolished in the last 20 years. And this is, you know, the greatest destruction, cultural destruction in Chinese history since the, you know, time of Genghis Khan. But I think, you know, in view of the fact that the party had made specific plans to preserve Beijing as much as possible and to preserve the original design of Beijing and keep the original pattern of many of the streets, some of which can be traced back over 1,000 years. I think this was a kind of deliberate decision, and because they were embarrassed by it, they decided to keep it secret. And therefore, I also don't think it was sort of reported in last year. This had very much to do with the Olympics. They were going to do this anyway. And I also think if you look at not only Jiang Zemin, but many of the other members of the current leadership and members of the Central Committee, a very large number of them are actually former Red Guards, and many of them, like Hu Jintao, were actually engineering graduates from Tsinghua University. And in many ways, I think there is a sort of continuation from the sort of Red Guard movement and the sort of frenzied destruction of China's cultural heritage and anything to do with the past. You know, that sort of line of thinking hasn't really changed, and the thinking of Hu Jintao and these other members of the Red Guard generation, that the past is bad, that it needs to be rewritten, that it needs to be changed, and people need to be kind of brainwashed, and that the state has to have a kind of monopoly on people's sort of collective memory of the past. I don't think that's really changed. And what's interesting about the Tsinghua connection is that Tsinghua is the home of a famous architectural department, which was set up by China's first architectural historian, Liang Zicheng. And he wrote the first history of Chinese architecture, because until he got around doing it during the 1930s, nobody inside or outside China actually thought there was such a thing as architectural history in China. They thought this was very much a kind of Western phenomenon, that the Chinese are basically sort of carried on building the same kind of buildings for thousands of years. And he set out to prove that this was not so, and there was a great deal of architecture which needed to be preserved, and he argued that this was part of keeping the historical memory of China, and he called Beijing history in stone, and he played a major role in actually preventing the communists from bombing the nationalist troops in Peking in 1948, and also in advising the Allies not to bomb Kyoto and other historical sites in Japan. And most people until then had assumed that China's sort of cultural treasures, its sort of heritage, were more tied up with the script and with the poetry, with the writing, and the written language. That was a sort of common thing in Chinese culture. And he then put up quite a struggle to preserve Beijing from Mao's aspirations, to rebuild Beijing as a proletarian city, as a city full of industrial chimney stacks. And of course, he and many of his colleagues were then persecuted by the Red Guards, and some of them during the anti-rioters campaign. And so as I was kind of writing the history of many of these people, I sort of began to realize, of course, that the debate that they were having in the 1950s about, you know, how to rebuild Tiananmen, how to whether to keep the city walls, you know, how to have a modern government in basically a medieval city, that this was part of a kind of a larger debate which had started in back in the 1890s, when, you know, people in China really began to think very hard about what was it that they wanted to adopt from Western civilization, from the outside world in general, and what was it about Chinese civilization which was worth preserving. And that actually this was a debate which had sort of gone on for a very long time, and you know, Mao and the other sort of younger radicals who came up to Beijing you know, the 1900s, 1910s, 1920s, were actually listened to many of the leading intellectuals at the time who advocated a wholesale revolution and destruction of Chinese culture, because it was sort of this Confucian feudal culture was regarded as something which was so huge and so immovable that it was holding back the whole modernization project of China. And, you know, and of course people advocated, you know, abandoning Chinese traditional medicine, the Chinese script, the characters, changing to Baihua, to colloquial Chinese, to not reading the classics, and it kind of went on to sort of almost every aspect of life. And I think, but by and large, it was really the communists who took the most extreme position on this, and in many ways, sort of writing the history of this, I sort of came to realize as well that what happened during the Cultural Revolution was not something exceptional, and was actually done wherever the communists went, and to some extent was supported by the KMT officials as well, right from the 1920s, that the desire to sort of turn, you know, temples into schools and that kind of thing, and to knock down city walls and build railways and put up Western architecture was, you know, was not just a phenomenon of the last 10 or 20 years in China, and that there had been a whole tradition which had sort of largely been suppressed in China of people who actually said, well, it's not necessary to sort of wholesale to discard everything from the past wholesale. There are a lot of things we could do. We can sort of create a kind of fusion architecture, and this was, you know, in Beijing, particularly espoused by Western architects. So the Xiehe Hospital in Beijing, which was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, is actually sort of one of those Chinese Western modern buildings that you find in Beijing. I think Beijing University, lots of buildings in Shanghai, they have this kind of fusion architecture. And that therefore there was a kind of sort of whole undercurrent which of a tradition which still survived to the present day. And so I devoted quite a lot of the book to actually writing about many of the people who I think put up a quite a heroic struggle in the face of, you know, pretty harsh repression to try and rescue as much as possible from this destruction, and to really defy the government at the risk of going to jail, and sometimes at the risk of their own lives. And so I've spent quite a lot of time in the book really looking at people who wanted to really preserve the real history of Beijing as much as possible, both the recent past and the ancient historical past. So quite a lot of the chapters are devoted to those people. And I think, you know, many of them kind of failed, but they did achieve a certain amount. And I think they've kind of implanted a consciousness amongst the general population which somehow will survive into the future, and people will, you know, one day return to kind of creating a more Chinese identity to Beijing. And I think as a kind of final thought, because I think my time is running out, you know, one of the kind of peculiar things about the rebuilding of Beijing is how actually people in Beijing took Hong Kong as a model. I mean, a lot of people had pictures of Hong Kong in the city planning department, had photos of Hong Kong showing all these skyscrapers. And I think, you know, as you remember, Deng Xiaoping wanted to encourage the multiplication of Hong Kongs in China. And Hong Kong became the sort of vision of a modern Chinese city that people wanted to duplicate, and to and to a large extent they've succeeded. They've, I think, built something like over 1,000 skyscrapers in Beijing and something like 2,000 in Shanghai. And but I think the, you know, the sort of the kind of revenge of the traditionalists will have to wait, I think, a few years until the current Red Guard generation has left power. So maybe I'll stop there and we'll take some questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Jasper. Can I just please remind you, when you do ask your questions, remind Jasper who you are. Maybe I'll just start while everyone puts on their thinking caps. I'm wondering whether or not Hong Kong could be a model for Beijing now in a completely different respect. The civic reaction to the destruction of the old Star Ferry Terminal really turned heritage preservation into a political issue. To the point where the chief executive wants to come and talk about it as a serious issue that actually does matter politically in Hong Kong. You referred to sort of individual heroes. There's always a lot of individual heroes in when Beijing and architecture and preservation is mentioned. But what about civic groups coming together? And there's so much room in China, whether it's over environmental issues or other issues, to kind of get organized and not get in trouble with the government. Is there any signs of that sort of reaction to the destruction of Beijing occurring?
Well, I think the destruction of Beijing was one of the consequences of the failure of the Tiananmen democracy movement. And I think if China had become a democracy, a more democratic country, which tolerated civic groups and NGOs, I don't think this kind of wholesale disruption in such a short period of time would have been possible. There were a lot of people I met during my years in Beijing who did want to create NGOs, who went around gathering signatures. There were a lot of you know, unusual communities there. There was the sort of Muslim Hui community, for instance, which tried to launch civic sort of collective court cases against the destruction of their neighborhood. And this was a community which had claims to have lived continuously in the same part of Beijing for 1,000 years. There was also a kind of Russian-Chinese community called the Albazinians, who also tried to do this kind of resistance. And there were many, many other examples of neighborhoods, but of course it was impossible for them to get their court cases heard. And of course, you know, people were threatened by thugs, they were threatened by being put into jail for organizing anti-government protests. So, of course, there is a China Protection Heritage Society, which does officially campaign, and there are a number of other initiatives by people in Beijing, but of course they're not terribly effective. But there is a certain amount of leverage that they do have, and that is, you know, the government occasionally whips up this hysteria about how these foreigners have stolen all of China's cultural relics, and there's supposed to be 1.6 million cultural relics around the world that they want to get back. I mean, this is a kind of falsification of history, really. But there is this sort of official line that preserving this patrimony is a good thing. So sometimes people have been able to twist that to their own advantage.
Thanks. Any questions from the floor? Bonnie Engel.
How do you do, and thank you for a lovely talk. I'm Bonnie Engel from the Asian Art Newspaper out of London, and I just recently visited Beijing and had the pleasure of seeing the Capitol Museum and had the pleasure of going to the Beijing Planning. It's a department, I don't think it's a museum, but seeing the huge diorama of Beijing. but you can't help but notice how few of the hutongs are gone. So on a visit to Hau Hai, I talked to some foreigners who were trying to adapt the few little hutong houses that are still left. And one of them told me that one of the problems with preserving the hutongs was that there was no infrastructure. There was no sewage, there was no water, potable water in the region, and there was no electrical conduits, and it was just more or less a physical problem, and in addition perhaps to being a political one. What do you feel about that?
Well, I think the government has spent something like, $200 billion on rebuilding Beijing. I think there would have been a few thousand dollars left to put in some new wiring in the hutongs and fix the roofs. I mean, I don't think this was really an obstacle. I think I've known quite a few people who've restored hutongs. It's not particularly difficult or expensive. I think some of the courtyard houses became slums, but that was a result of government policies because they crammed in a lot of people there during the Cultural Revolution, and then they, the owners, when they got their deeds back, they couldn't get rid of these people without rehousing them. So there was no money, nobody had any interest in spending any money on them. And then the sort of government then disregarded the legal rights of the owners of these courtyard houses by declaring most of them as slums, as dangerous housing, which is sort of the trick they were doing in Kashgar and in Lhasa and everywhere else. And I think there are a lot of people who were very willing to spend money on the courtyard houses and put in some proper plumbing and so on. I mean, many of them were slums, it is true, and but that was a result of, I think, of government policies.
Actually, there's a technical term for that. It's called planning blight, and it's used in Hong Kong all the time, and it'll be a big thing that Donald Chung will talk about on his speech, because what happens in Hong Kong, we've got these areas like in Mong Kok or over in Tok Kwa Wan, which are very old areas that were built after the war. And as Jasper's just explained, we have the same problem of multiple ownership, meaning no one really wants to spend too much money when they know these areas will be bought by government and redeveloped. One thing I just want to ask you, Jasper, is it's interesting, if you go talk to people, and many bureaucrats in Hong Kong, they come back from China and they complain that Hong Kong is so developed now, undeveloped compared to China. And if you look at West Kowloon, what's happening there, that area where the ICC building is being built, the other very tall building, that whole area is has just sprung out of without any public debate at all.
I think it is quite astonishing what's been done to rehouse something like 200 million people, the urban population of China, sort of, you know, in 10 or 15 years. I mean, it's been this extraordinary thing, and they have planned and you know, executed this. I mean, it's quite a sort of managerial, I mean, it's quite an extraordinary achievement by any standards. And many people would say a lot of people have benefited by it because they live in now in better housing. I mean, I think in Shanghai, you know, 20 years ago, the average living space was something like 3.4 square meters per person. And so it's sort of tripled or quadrupled in most Chinese cities. But I don't think, you know, there was any contradiction between preserving old buildings, you know, in parts of a large city, the historic core of a city, and you know, rehousing a lot of people. And I don't think it's necessary that, you know, everything should look like a sort of a kind of Gothic railway station or a sort of Ming Dynasty temple. But I think if but I think you know there is a sort of political agenda behind this kind of thing, because you do wipe out the past, you do destroy people's historical attachment to their places. And in Beijing, the you know every street, every house had some historical significance, and it allows you to completely reinvent your past, which is sort of what they've done in China. And I think it's not just the sort of last 100 years, the modern past, but you know the sort of whole historical narrative of China has been reshaped and sort of drummed into people. You know, because of course Beijing was not really a Chinese city for most of its history, but was actually a history that belonged to the Manchus or the Mongols or the Khitan or whoever. And so a lot of the, you know, the reinvention of Beijing's history has a lot to do with the current Chinese government's claims to all these non-Han Chinese territories, because they sort of allow themselves to kind of reinvent these this history to sort of justify the claims to the former bits of the former sort of Qing or Mongol Empire. But that's kind of a big subject.
A question from front here. Sorry, the mic's coming.
You seem to be holding out some kind of hope. Or see something in the next generation, this post-Red Guard generation. Could you elaborate on that a bit? Because if you've already lost the history in stone, you've already lost the history in textbooks and in other written documents, what is it that these people are going to tap into? You talk about rewriting the past, changing the historical narrative. What exactly, what hope are you drawing out of from the future?
Well, because I have met a lot of people while I've lived in China who are very concerned about preserving the past and their cultural and historical identity. And you know, one of the strange sort of events, one of the chapters I write about is sort of the role of religion in China. And one of the things that particularly struck me was the Falun Gong movement. And you know, one of the interesting things about that, there were a lot of people in the senior leadership of the Communist Party who joined the Falun Gong movement or other of these similar movements which sprang up, and actually really wanted to reject this whole kind of westernization of Chinese culture, this whole creating this sort of completely rational society. And they actually wanted to believe in that China had its own traditions, and that to me, the Falun Gong movement was a kind of rejection of everything that the current leadership is all about, and I think that's why they've been so harsh. And so I think there's this sort of huge reservoir of, you know, hundreds of millions of people in China who don't really, you know, who don't really agree with what the Communist Party is about, this completely cold and rational science, pseudo-scientific world that they've created. And to me, the fact that they had sort of, you know, this Li Hongzhi had all these devotees in Zhongnanhai sort of tells you something about what people really think about the modernization project in China, that there are a lot of people who actually reject it. And so I think there is this sort of deep reservoir of hostility towards it, and so given the chance, this would at some point break into the open, and people would want to go back to seeing themselves as kind of Chinese, and therefore as part of a great tradition, and would want to express that in the architecture.
I think we can take another probably two questions.
I'm Bob Meyer of PharmaLink. You've touched on this point already, but it seems to me that the words ironic, contradictory, or hypocritical certainly come to mind when one looks at China's views of the patrimony that was taken by the Kuomintang to Taiwan, and as you said, their extreme effort to try to recover cultural relics overseas. In your mind, how has this come about? Why is there not, I know you've touched on this through the whole presentation, but what do you think are the first, second, and third reasons why there's no sense that China's losing something very valuable, that the next generation already is sorry about and future generations are going to be very sorry about?
Well, I think what they sort of manipulate the past to suit their own political purposes, and that's sort of one of the sort of malevolent aspects of this. I mean, with the zodiac heads, it's actually by chance. It was one of the things I sort of looked at a bit when I was writing the book, because there's a chapter about the Yuan Min Yuan, and it was pretty clear to me from what I read, particularly a book by a writer called Hope Danby, that the fountain, which as you know was built by and designed by these French Jesuits at the court of the Qing Dynasty, was actually dismantled and destroyed, you know, at least 20 or 30 years before the British and French troops arrived in China and sacked the Summer Palace. And I actually heard a story when I was sort of researching the chapter on the relics that these heads were actually sold by the Chinese government in sort of 79, 80 or 81. I interviewed this famous American art collector, Robert Ellsworth, and he said he and other American collectors, when the two countries reestablished diplomatic relations, would be brought to Beijing and they'd be taken to these gigantic warehouses where all this stuff had been collected, which had sort of been seized or stolen from people, and there'd be these huge warehouses. Nobody really knew what all this stuff was, and you would be invited to sort of buy batches of it, you know, by weight actually. And there was one American businesswoman who told me she took a client, an American multimillionaire, to China on some business trip, and he went to one of these warehouses and he bought something like, he signed a check for like $5 million worth of this stuff and shipped it back to his house in was either Hawaii or California anyway, and that's where one of the heads ended up, in the swimming pool of this guy. And so it's obvious that the Chinese who were selling, the officials who were selling this stuff, didn't know what it was, and nor did the guy buying it. I mean, it was just some kind of old junk. And of course, you wouldn't have expected the troops to have sort of carried off these, you know, bronze heads, which had no intrinsic values, weren't even Chinese. Why would you have taken the trouble to sort of dig these heads up and ship them back to Europe when you had so much else you could steal? So it seemed to me this is a kind of classic example of what the Chinese government does, because they were, you know, very angry at the French over Tibet. And they decided to sort of dig this up as an example of how invidious the foreigners are, and to sort of whip up this sort of patriotism amongst people. And that's really why they do a lot of these things, so that they themselves have a monopoly over this patriotism. And you know, it was striking to me as well that you know, that this was linked to Tibet, because you compare what the British and French did in, you know, in 1860 with what the the PLA did in Tibet in the 1950s, and that was a deliberate planned destruction of Tibet's cultural heritage. And I met the founder of the Shanghai Museum, a man called Ma Cheng Yuan, and I was sort of interviewing him for a story for the Post, and he started telling about how when he was in the Cultural Relics Bureau in 1958, he was recruited with a team of other people to go around Tibet and to pick out things which were going to be saved, you know, an example of you know, a tanker from this dynasty or bronze from that period. And all the rest, it had already been decided, was going to be destroyed. And they spent 6 months going around Tibet, and they methodically destroyed everything else in the temples. And the party went from temple to temple, shrine to shrine, from house to house, and systematically collected everything from the past, people's jewelry, all their possessions, and either burned them or put them in museums. Hundreds of tons of the stuff was shipped back and melted down. And they must have collected, you know, from Tibet, you know, 1,000 years of sort of gold and silver and jewels, which was all, you know, most of it was destroyed. And it was worth billions and billions of dollars. And a lot of the carpets sort of were sold at the Canton Fair. Anyway, I put a lot of details about this. But this was actually, if you're talking about, you know, people destroying a foreign culture, you know, there's no worse example than what the Chinese did to the Tibetans. So there was a kind of incredible sort of hypocrisy about this. And I think they sort of use this idea that it's the foreigners who destroyed our past, not we ourselves, as a kind of protective mechanism to sort of ward off criticism. But there are quite a few, you know, people in China who don't really buy this, and one of them is the Tianjin writer Feng Jitai, who's sort of written quite a lot about this. And I mean, there are, you know, other people who are aware of this.
Last question here, please.
Mark Sutherland. What is the approach to Western buildings? For example, in Shanghai, the old cathedral, I understand, was or is about to be restored. What is your view on that?
Shanghai is kind of a strange story because, you know, it's, quite a few people have been able to reclaim their houses there. They've done a slightly better job in Shanghai than in Beijing. The Anglican Cathedral is one of the things that's been protected, but a lot of other stuff has been destroyed. I mean, most of old Shanghai has gone. But they did manage to preserve the Bund and a few other places. And what I always found strange about Shanghai is actually, you know, they were kind of like destroying this evidence of sort of foreign colonialism, but actually a lot of the new developments around the outskirts are deliberately sort of patterned on Western architecture. So there's a kind of, you know, this Thames Town, I'm sure you've heard about, which is a kind of model of a kind of a British small country town with a kind of pub and all the rest of it and a church. And, you know, they don't have thatched roofs, but they have sort of timber and brick houses. And I think there are all kinds of other sort of mock, I think there are about a dozen mock foreign towns around Shanghai. So in a way, actually, people like... I actually like the idea of living in foreign buildings, and it's only recently that a few wealthy people in Beijing and other places have started saying, oh, maybe it'd be quite nice to, you know, have a kind of courtyard house in grey brick. And there's kind of been a vogue for this sort of Ming Dynasty furniture because it's sort of very simple and unadorned and modernistic. And but what I really regret, and what I always found, you know, tremendously exciting about China and Chinese culture in the broadest sense, was this incredible diversity that you had in China of different architecture and clothing and cultural traditions. And you know, what's very sad about traveling around China is that you get this total monoculture now.
Jasper, thank you very much for a very interesting talk. We always love speakers who don't pull punches. We have a small piece of FCC heritage to give you. FCC polo shirt. I'm very sorry that Beijing is losing you to Bath, but I'm sure you'll enjoy the Roman ruins there. So please join us, join me in thanking Jasper for the talk today. Jasper is happy to sign books if anybody out there would like that. I would just suggest, if you do, to please come up from the stage on my left and form a relatively orderly queue.